when we do not prepare to maintain the institutions of the Congress or the courts or the executive branch in a constitutionally valid way, we are violating our sacred oath. Right now, capable, competent, dedicated public servants, the people who were elected to serve and represent their constituents, are being prevented by leadership from fulfilling their constitutional duties.
I'm Margaret Taylor, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 20th, 2020. On April 16th, former members of Congress participated in a mock remote hearing via Zoom to test the viability of online congressional proceedings during the COVID-19 pandemic. Former General David Petraeus testified along with representatives from Zoom, Microsoft Teams, and other experts. A member of the UK Parliament testified about how the UK Parliament is innovating to meet the demands of social distancing. In this episode of the Lawfare Podcast, I talked with former Congressman Brian Baird, who chaired the mock hearing, and David Schuman, a lawyer, technologist, and government transparency advocate who testified. We talked about Congress's rather timid efforts so far to innovate in the age of social distancing, and ways Congress could continue to do hearings, markups, and floor votes in a live, digital, remote format. We talked about the constitutional underpinnings of remote work by Congress and the importance of robust legislative and oversight work in a representative democracy, especially in the midst of a national crisis. The mock hearing we discuss in this episode is up on YouTube, and a link to it can be found on this episode's show page. It's the Lawfare Podcast. Former Congressman Brian Baird and Daniel Schuman on how Congress can continue to function remotely. So I want to set the stage for our listeners a bit. Obviously, in this age of COVID-19 and social distancing, members of Congress are back at home in their districts. And it's not entirely clear, at least to me, when they will be coming back. There's some indication that it might be around May 5th, but perhaps not. And it's not clear exactly, even if they do come back to be in session in some form around that time, it's not exactly clear, you know, what types of things they will be doing and not doing. So I want to start with this idea of, you know, there are things that Congress should be doing, right? There's hearings to be done, oversight, markups, voting on the floor. How is it, Congressman Baird, how is it you think this is going to sort of unfold over the next few weeks and months?
Well, I'm sorry to say, I don't think it's unfolding very well, and it has certainly not unfolded well up to this point. Congress has a constitutional responsibility to perform its duties, and the framers wanted that to happen. That includes everything from oversight, as you mentioned, to appropriating funding. All the agenda that normally Congress would do, even if there weren't a COVID virus, all of that is frozen. And effectively, the members themselves are not being involved in any of that right now, or very, very little at least. And neither are they present to address the COVID crisis. And it's inexcusable, frankly, because the technology is available for them to meet right now. And the technology is already in use in other countries and in states and municipalities to actually conduct voting. So it's an inexcusable absence at a terrible time to be away from work. Even if you can't be there physically, you could be there remotely and have meaningful hearings and substantive votes.
And so let's dwell a little bit on the sort of what I see as skepticism, which might be changing a little bit, but there does seem to be a sort of pall of skepticism in Congress, and particularly among leadership. Nancy Pelosi on the House side, the House Speaker, and Mitch McConnell on the Senate side. So skepticism about changing the way Congress does its business, very traditional sort of ideas about, you know, being very conservative about changing the rules. So Congressman, just talk to us a little bit about how you view that skepticism. Where does it come from exactly? As you said, you know, there are parliaments and legislative bodies sort of innovating around the world. It doesn't seem to be as big a deal. What is the particular skepticism in Congress? You were in Congress for, I think, 12 years, representing Washington State's 3rd Congressional District. These are your peers. So, you know, why do you think there are so many people who are skeptical?
Well, I think people feel rooted to tradition, and they assume that rootedness to tradition is tantamount to being consistent with the Constitution. And the Constitution allows, in my judgment, and many other scholars, would allow remote voting if the House and Senate would amend their rules. And as you mentioned, and as our hearing on Thursday amply demonstrated, other parliamentary bodies around the world are in fact meeting, and they're having meaningful dialogue, just as we did on Thursday, and they're having important and substantive votes. You know, it's tempting to say that the skepticism is rooted in the 1800s, not in the year 2020. Look, our kids right now, a little bit later this morning, my kids will start effectively going to school. They'll connect via remote link with their teachers. They'll do their homework online. The corporate world has long been doing this. We heard outstanding testimony from General David Petraeus about how he managed the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and his duties as head of the CIA. Much of that done with remote video conference. And yet the Congress of the United States has implemented a rather pathetic and Byzantine way of proxy voting by calling someone by phone, maybe, and giving them your proxy, rather than actually having a meaningful online, real-time, visual link up with other colleagues and with the body. It's shameful and kind of embarrassing if it weren't for it being so consequential.
So before we move to talking about the mock hearing, which I participated in and I very much enjoyed, and both of you were players in, Daniel, I just want to ask you, there's different things, right, that Congress has to do. There's hearings, there's markups, there's remote voting. What do you see as, okay, so let's start with the Constitution. Do you see there being any constitutional barriers or questions about, you know, first, let's talk about hearings first, and then also remote voting?
So it's probably best to think of this sort of in a framework. Let's start with public proceedings, and then we can talk about non-public proceedings, because that's a whole different can of worms. But for public proceedings, you have the ability to vote on the floor. You have the ability to debate on the floor, and that includes introducing amendments and introducing legislation and things like that. And then you have in the committees, it's the same thing. It's the ability to hold hearings and conduct oversight and compel witnesses and obtain testimony and documents and drafting legislation and going through markups and those kinds of things. So that's sort of the boxes that exist. And where we are now is last week, the House of Representatives, but not the Senate, has allowed for a mechanism to email in requests to introduce legislation or co-sponsor legislation. And the proposal, which hasn't yet been adopted in the House, would allow for the ability to use this proxy voting system that has never been used before on either chamber's floor, where you ask some other member to vote for you. So when you look at the Constitution says that each chamber has the ability to set their own procedures. And as long as they do so in a reasonable way, the courts are not going to interfere. And in the context of a pandemic where being around each other is particularly dangerous, the courts are going to give a lot of deference to Congress, even assuming that they can find that someone has standing to raise objections in these contexts. There have been two relevant Supreme Court decisions. There was a decision in the 1890s that had to do with when the House changed the way it calculated quorum, which is figuring out how many people are present. And the upshot of the court's decision is the House and Senate can basically do what they want as long as it's, you know, reasonable around the idea of figuring out whether a majority are present. And present is not defined. Presence doesn't have to be physical presence, according to the Constitution. It doesn't require that. It just simply says present. It doesn't even say a majority. Oftentimes, the House and Senate will operate without a majority being present, or they'll hold votes by unanimous consent, where you've got one or two or four or five people there, and that's certainly not a majority. And the courts have basically left that alone. So the constitutional perspective, in terms of determining quorum, it largely leaves it up to the chamber. But there's a catch. And the catch is this decision from the 1940s, where it was a circumstance where a witness was held in contempt. And what the court said is that you have to follow your own rules. So if you break your own rules and there is a consequence that comes from that, then the courts may intervene. Now, this was the facts of this case that had to do with Red Scare. So like the courts were particularly likely and inclined to sort of knock down the conviction on the basis of someone lying about whether they were communists, which is what the case had to do with. So there was an antipathy from the courts towards the facts of the case. But as a general rule, the Constitution, while it has some provisions that do require assembling perhaps once a year, that's kind of it. And that the House and the Senate have great leeway to do whatever they need to do. And if you look at the sort of the history of all of this, what the framers were thinking about was that they wanted Congress to be able to work because the thing that they feared the most was an unchecked executive branch. And that's what Congress is there for. So the theory that Congress wouldn't be able to work for weeks or months or years at a time because it's physically unsafe to be together, the founders would look at that and say, well, of course they can change the rules so that they can make sure that they can continue to function, because that's the entire point of having a legislative body, is to conduct oversight and to legislate.
So let's think particularly about committee hearings, because the really neat event that you all put on yesterday, where you actually had former members of Congress sort of serving as mock congressmen and women, asking questions of three different panels of witnesses. And as Congressman Baird alluded to before, General David Petraeus was the first witness, and the congressmen and women asked questions. Do you see any changes that would need to be made to either, to the rules, basically, for that type of virtual hearing in a committee in, for example, the House right now?
Well, having chaired that, I can tell you it's a different experience chairing it. Let me roll back for just a sec. Earlier, I may have been not charitable enough. I, you know, part of the reason members of Congress say they're concerned about remote voting is they're worried, or remote hearings, they're worried that this would somehow impede the ability of members to have the informal dialogue and build the personal relationships from afar that are so central to the work of Congress. And I actually respect that a great deal. At the same time, I think many Americans are realizing that there are ways to have meaningful dialogue and interactions and personal relationships from afar. It's not the same, but it is, under the circumstances, what we have to do. And so Congress needs to say it's not what we used to do, but it is what we have to do. And let's accept that fact and let's move forward. So in the case of a hearing, a couple of things. First of all, you know, the normal hearings of Congress, there's an assumption that the status quo was perfect. It isn't. The hearings are good generally and meaningful, but there's a lot of wasted time and a lot of, you know, posturing, et cetera. And that is harder to do a little bit electronically. There's a desire and a need to cut to the chase a little bit. Among the changes are these. It's hard to manage the recognition of members when you've got a large group of members and the chair can't see them and they're raising their hands on Zoom. We managed it quite well yesterday, I think. I may have, and I apologize if I missed one or two people. But in general, we were able to balance between parties and interests and be fair and objective. You'll need a fair and objective and impartial chair to do that. But that's true in regular hearings as well. I think members will have to have some forbearance and some patience as they wait their turn. But that is also true in regular hearings. From a rules perspective, the last thing I'll say is that there's a tradition, a practice that members are each given 5 minutes of time to either talk, make speeches, or ask questions. That becomes a little problematic, I think, in the regular hearings anyway, but it is also a challenge online. We just didn't have time to do it yesterday. And when you have a lot of members, it would just drag out unreasonably. But from a practical, what is the purpose of a hearing perspective? If you believe the purpose of a hearing is to gather information from expert witnesses and have meaningful discussion of that, you can quite well do that online. And I think we proved that yesterday.
Yeah, I know. I was convinced. I found it to be very informative, very much like a live hearing. And there were a few times when, for example, one of the witnesses would accidentally be muted and start talking, and there was like a little glitch there. But it kind of reminded me of what happens physically in a hearing room often when a witness will start talking and the chairman or chairwoman will have to say, oh, you know, please turn on your mic. I mean, it was not unlike that type of experience. It was actually kind of funny. It's like almost like a universal type of thing that happens during these hearings. One of the panels, I thought all three panels were very interesting. The second panel was a representative from Zoom government and then also Microsoft Teams. And they talked a little bit about sort of the security concerns and challenges of this space. So what did you think of sort of their, you know, quote testimony, mock testimony? And, you know, what are your, do you have concerns about the security of these, for example, doing hearings, or, you know, the ability of some random person from the public being able to come in and sort of mess things up? You know, what were you made more comfortable by the responses from those two witnesses on the second mock panel from yesterday? And that's a question for both of you.
Well, I think that, Daniel, I'll have you talk in just a second. I think the first thing to note is that we had a two-hour hearing with some pretty impressive witnesses, and there was that we didn't get bombed. We didn't get interrupted. We managed it. We had certain protocols that, you know, we curated who could get in, et cetera, et cetera. But it was not disrupted. And as Chi Onwura, the member of parliament from the UK, points out, it's not like your in-person hearings never get disrupted. Protesters come in and you shout and sometimes are removed or they hold up signs or whatever. So no system, I hope, we'll always have ways for people to observe and offer observations and input, but we can still have an orderly process. Now, in some cases, there will need to be secure channels. If you've got final markups where your discussion, especially in conference committees, right before final passage, those kind of meetings by tradition are not held in the public eye, and that's for good reason. People are doing some negotiation and adjustments to the bill, and those adjustments have major consequence. But in the normal hearing, normally they're open to observation by the general public, and there's no reason these can't be as well. We didn't do it yesterday just because it was a trial run, but and normally there's no reason they couldn't be open to the public.
Yeah, so in I think it's worth, and I think Congressman Baird's points are exactly right. And I think it's worth deconstructing a little bit what people mean by the security concerns, because it seems that there's a couple things that sort of get mushed together and that we should separate them. So one is the idea that unwanted people are going to interrupt the proceedings, which is, as Congressman Baird noted and General Petraeus noted, happens in physical meetings as well. And if you configure the technology appropriately, like through the webcasting on Zoom, which is what we were using, it addresses that problem, right? If you have passwords and unique links and you have a waiting room, basically, the ability of people to disrupt or interrupt what's going on doesn't happen. A second security concern is the idea that the teleconferencing platform in some way can be listened in on. Well, in a public proceeding, that's kind of the point, right? You want people listening in. So if you're broadcasting it live on YouTube and on Facebook and on whatever the platforms that you're using, the fact that someone could listen into the conversation isn't a problem. And the third concern is that there is a security glitch in the platform in some fashion where someone can reach through, you know, WebEx and steal stuff off your computer, which is also a potential concern, although they're all using a level of encryption that makes it unlikely, and that you probably have to be a fairly sophisticated state actor to break it to go through and steal stuff. And that is also fairly easily solvable by you give the members of Congress a separate device, just like what we do currently for the president. The president has a separate device for tweeting versus for his phone calls versus for something else. And that way, even if they can reach through and they can break into the device, there's nothing to steal because there's nothing there, because it is a dedicated device that is used solely for these types of communications. And that creates a firewall around where even if it's, you know, you can sort of hack into it, doesn't get you any place. So these types of security are largely solvable. These are technology questions that are readily dealt with all the time. Now, if you go to secure proceedings, in-camera proceedings, then it's a different question. But this is also a solved problem because the military and the FBI and a bunch of other people have figured out methods, and we can get into it if you want, about how you would set up secure communications where you can share the bills and the bill text and the, you know, and have a conversation about things that are classified, because that is something that is also capable of being done. But it's a lot more complicated than jumping on like Zoom or WebEx to do it.
Let me jump in, Daniel, too, because the other issue about security is, okay, well, maybe someone could disrupt a vote. They could sort of falsely pretend to be Brian Baird and vote in my name. But that's easily solvable. And the Brazilians have solved it with a very simple phone app that you have to take your picture and submit your vote, and then it registers. The Spanish have been doing this. Other countries have been doing it. The UK is working on it. If I'm on video with you and you ask me how I vote and you see my face and I say, Mr. Baird votes aye, and that aye appears on the screen on the voting tally publicly, And if I'm watching that and somehow it shows up as a no, you just have a channel through which I could say, wait a minute, that's not how I voted. And everybody saw it. So it's pretty far-fetched that a public vote online is easily going to be disrupted. The other thing I'll say is the solution, in quotes, that the House Rules Committee has proposed right now, as Daniel said, is this proxy system.
And just to clarify for our listeners, so Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, has actually, I think, warmed up a little bit to some of these ideas. And she and the chairman of the Rules Committee have sort of are more open to this. And they've proposed a quite modest proxy voting scheme. So, Congressman, can you kind of describe that for the listeners and then give your view of it?
Well, as I understand it, basically, there will be someone physically present in the Capitol, and they will be in contact with the remote members. And the remote members will tell that person how they want to cast their vote. And that person will cast the vote as they are instructed to do so. So it's as if you could send somebody into the chamber with your voting card to cast your vote. Daniel, if you feel I've characterized it in a different way, go ahead and jump in. And then I want to talk about whether.
So I would just say one thing, that the way they're proposing it is that it's not a blank check.
Right.
So that for each vote, you would have to get sufficient notice in advance of what's being voted on, and you would give very specific instructions on this bill without these amendments. Vote this way. Which can be a very kind of onerous process to like have to, you know, sign a document that says that and send it in. But as you've described it is right. But I should just mention it's very specific. It's not a general authorization to vote how you feel, but it's a very specific vote on a very specific matter.
But here's the irony of this: the people who are opposed to remote voting and remote hearings always argue, or most of them argue, that hey, the human one-on-one interaction and personal relationship is central to the legislative process. But then they've put forward a proposal that basically eliminates the human one-on-one interaction. And let me give you an example of that. When you vote on the floor, especially in politically sensitive or policy complicated votes, we often look to other members who we trust and respect, and we sit down next to them and say, help me understand why you voted this way. I'm trying to decide pro or con on this. I've studied it. I've thought about it, but it could go either way. What's your thinking? And you find people you trust and respect. If we had remote interactions in real time where I could, if Daniel's one of those folks, at which he would be, I respect, I could call Daniel and I could chat with him and say, Daniel, I see you voted no. I was leaning yes. Walk me through this real quick in real time. Daniel could explain it. And then in real time, I could adjust my vote or keep it as I thought I was going to do. You can't do that in this system, this proxy system they've put forward. There's no practical way to do it. So it's hugely inconsistent to say we must have one-on-one interpersonal relationships, dialogue, deliberation, etc., but we're going to implement a proposed solution that prevents all those things that they've said were sacrosanct, when there is actually an alternative that would in some ways preserve all those things that are so important.
And if I can add, and I think there's a constitutional dynamic to this as well, which is that while the House and Senate each have the ability to set their own rules, it has to be reasonably aimed at attaining their purpose. Things that are more like what you're already doing is probably better than things that are further away from it.
Amen.
So being able to have everybody in the room, basically virtually in the room, where you can see them and hear them, they can see you and hear you, and you can argue and reason with each other. Like this is the platonic ideal of what a Congress would be, not necessarily what always happens, but that ability to interact and to offer amendments if they're permitted under the House rules and to do all the other things that one would do, it's better when you're doing it live. And what you have instead is like this weird punctuated circumstance where, you know, you get the bill and then you sit and you decide and then you send in your vote and you can't, it's very hard to deal with the changing circumstances. It's very herky jerky. It's further away from this ideal of reasoned debate together, of the members coming together. You know, we talk about that. We get hit with the, you know, Congress means coming together. Well, this isn't a coming together. This is something else. It's further away from the idea. And while I think it would still be constitutional, it's not as good as being able to actually be the one to engage in the voting process yourself.
You know, this so-called remedy could have been put forward in 1862, because in 1861, the Transcontinental Telegraph was completed, and you could have telegraphed your vote from California or wherever and said, well, this is how I want you to vote. But there would have been no discussion. There would have been no real-time feedback. Imagine the alternative, of course, is that in real time, you're seeing who's voting how. You can adjust. You can change. On very controversial votes, it is not uncommon for people to wait towards the end to see what the total of the vote tally is, who's voted how, what is the meaning of my vote. Sometimes you'll say to yourself, I really don't like this bill, but I don't want to be the person who defeats it, or I really do like this bill, but I don't want to vote for it because it's politically hard. Those are all things that are allowed. If we had remote observation, real-time voting with meaningful discussion online as it's happening, it would be so much closer to what we're really doing. And the great irony here is the very people who are defending a traditional way of doing this have violated almost all the precepts that they argue are so essential.
So it seems to me that, you know, just reading the press, that Speaker Pelosi is maybe evolving a little bit, perhaps based on some pressure from her members and maybe a realization that this COVID-19 is with us for months and months. So there does seem to be a little bit of evolution going on. Maybe there will be more. Talk to me about what's happening on the Senate side, because I haven't seen much movement at all over there. What are you seeing on the Senate side?
Well, before we do that, let's talk a little bit about what's happening a little further about what's happening among the public. The public, 80% or more, say they think Congress should meet remotely. They understand that we are in a crisis and they are perplexed. And I will tell you, especially the Democratic side, average Democratic voters keep saying, where are the Democrats in the House and Senate? Why are they not speaking up? We have a very problematic, autocratic, and incompetent president getting all the attention and doing things that are very questionable. The Dems aren't there to act. So the general public, especially the Democratic side, is desperate for the Congress and the House especially to meet. The members of the Congress, I think it's now more than 100 or so, have sent a letter saying they want some form of remote interaction. On the Senate, you've got Rob Portman and Dick Durbin, a bipartisan, very respected, relatively senior members of the Senate, saying they want to explore remote interactions and do so quickly. So the question, I think, on McConnell's part is he's always been comfortable with an autocratic president who disregards the Article I branch. So this is manna from heaven for him. He thinks this is great. This president can go unfettered and do whatever the heck he wants. And I have no real duty to have a check and balance in that. So it's the ultimate enabler for Mitch McConnell.
I would say a couple of things. One is that we're seeing the committees trying to innovate here in the Senate, just like they are trying to innovate in the House, where we saw an effort to hold paper hearings, which is not a real thing, but it's fine. We're seeing them meeting, not having official meetings, but having unofficial meetings and trying to figure out the appropriations process because that's coming up. Trying to figure out the National Defense Authorization Act, because that's a bill that gets passed every year. So we see the committees trying to lead on this, but we don't see, you know, the pressure that's going to come on McConnell. And we saw sort of a head fake on this from the president earlier this week, I think, is confirming judges and confirming government officials. Now, the president hasn't really cared much about moving people from being acting to being permanent inside the executive branch. But McConnell's legacy and President Trump's main argument is, look at what I'm doing to the courts. And the Senate can't do anything to confirm these folks because they can't meet. So there will be a pressure that will build up to go and find a way for them to meet, not to pass the laws that they should be passing or conducting the oversight that they should be conducting, but to go and solidify the change that's been happening inside the courts. And as long as the Senate is out and they can't have these meetings and they can't vote, then it undermines the president and Mitch McConnell's number one priority of transforming the courts into something entirely different from what they've been for the last 50 years.
So just looking forward to even the next few weeks, you know, what are the key things that each of you see as, you know, if you could have your druthers and have both the Senate and the House side do one thing, what would it be? Would it be, you know, put in place the ability to do oversight hearings of the administration, or would it be put in place the ability to do effective real-time remote voting? You know, recognizing there's going to be things that are opposed by certain members, supported by certain members. What is the one thing that you all see as sort of the next really key innovation for making sure the Article One branch of government remains, you know, relevant and important and part of the dialogue?
Well, I won't say one thing. I'll say a series of things. One, start hearings tomorrow. We've shown that it's possible. We've shown it can be meaningful. Start hearings tomorrow. Identify which priorities should be there. Move forward with those. Second, schedule an absolute date by which you will allow remote voting at the committee level first, and then a follow-up date at which you will allow remote voting on final passage. Learn from the other parliamentarians and the technology companies about how that is done. Follow the example of the states and implement it. They must pass a fourth stimulus package. They need to do serious monitoring of the ones that have already been passed. And let me just add one other thing, and I hope we'll get to this before we close today. There's this assumption that the only problem we're facing right now is the COVID health and economic issues. We have malevolent state actors out there, North Korea and plus terrorist organizations, who could easily disrupt even this chaos. And again, the Congress is not able to meet. It's not just that they can't respond to this crisis, and it's not just that they can't do their normal business. If something far worse emerges, and there's no reason to believe it couldn't do so, it'd be a good time to attack, actually, we are further incapacitated. And then last but not least, and this is the longer term, we've got to deal with the underlying fact that our country has no viable constitutionally valid mechanism for continuity of any of the three major branches of our government.
Yeah. And, you know, I was going to close with the sort of broader continuity of government project. Before we talk a little bit more about that, though, Daniel, do you want to weigh in what the sort of you think is the most important sort of next step?
So I think that there's two. The first is they have to reopen both floors. Like the House and Senate have to get back to work. And if they can get the floors open, that will allow them to go and reopen the committees. And Brian, Congressman Baird is right that they need to go and start their hearings and markups now. They've already lost 33 days, 34 days since the last hearing in the House. Like they need to start immediately. The other thing they need to do is when they go and pass the stimulus bill or whatever it is that they're going to pass, they need to make more money available for congressional modernization. All of this technology costs money. All of this oversight costs money. House committees alone are down $100 million in funding over the last decade. How are they going to conduct oversight over the entire panoply of matters that Congress needs to oversee when they don't have the personnel to do it? And at the same time, if they're going to build technological solutions that allow them to do the work that they need to do, we've seen, you know, the legislative branch has tremendously underinvested in its own capacity over the last 25 or 30 years. They need to start bending that arc back in the right direction. We can see that austerity is coming. Everything's going to get cut massively next year. Like there is no doubt that once we get past people going back to work, that, you know, there will be this clampdown that's going to happen, which means that as we're passing these giant stimulus bills that don't have to follow the usual rules regarding how spending is done, we need to go and invest in the systems architecture and the personnel and the modernization and the staff and change fundamentally the way that Congress works. Because what you can have is what we have right now, which is that everybody saw this coming. I mean, Speaker Pelosi says that no one saw this coming. There were letters on this 6 months ago. Like everybody saw this coming, but they weren't ready for it. And they're not ready for it because they didn't invest in their capacity to be ready for it. And the only time that we're ever going to get them to focus on it is in the face of an emergency, which is right now, which means that they have to go and spend the money as well as do the intellectual work to make sure that the House and Senate chamber rules are changed so that we don't have this problem again.
Yeah, that John, you mentioned, I think we both should have probably started with this. The first order of business, I believe, is probably that they need to meet in some fashion in order to change the rules. And that rule change should be some sort of an enabling rule, which would say that perhaps present shall be defined as blah, 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 so that they can allow, they can create an underlying rule change that allows for remote protocols to move forward on both the hearing front and the final vote and committee votes. That should be step one.
Yeah, I think that makes sense because they will need at least some changes to those rules. And just to sort of close this out, I know Congressman, and maybe you too, Daniel, have worked on broader sort of continuity of Congress, which you referred to earlier, Congressman Baird. A lot of work was put into that around 9/11, but it didn't really go anywhere and is now being revived a little bit. What do you think the chances are for members of Congress understanding the importance of putting, you know, firm, doable, workable continuity protocols at this moment?
Well, let me thank you for that question. Your listeners would do well to spend a little bit of time reading three documents. There was a commission created after 9/11 called the Continuity of Government Commission. They wrote three reports. The first deals with continuity of the Congress. The second deals with the presidency and the line of succession. And the third deals with the continuity of the Supreme Court. The terrifying fact is that we have not got a constitutionally valid and practical mechanism for any of the branches of government if a more severe pandemic starts incapacitating or killing large numbers, or a malevolent attack from a hostile force instantaneously wipes out the three branches. We have no valid plan. Every single one of them is flawed. Now, and let me give you one quick example in the House because it's shocking. If, say, a terrorist attack or a really lethal pandemic hits and takes out most of the House of Representatives, the question is, how do you do business in the legislative branch when you've got a bicameral system? If the House can't act, you can't appropriate money, you can't deal with taxes, you can't declare war in theory and in practice. So here's what happens. The Republicans some years ago changed the House rules, and the Democrats have persisted with them, such that the quorum of the House is no longer a majority as explicitly specified in the Constitution. The quorum can be lowered effectively to almost nil. Basically what happens if a number of people get killed or incapacitated, they have an extended quorum call. Whoever responds to that becomes the full House. So if 10 people show up and say, we're still alive, that's the full House. Half of that would constitute a quorum, according to their definition, and half of that would be a majority. And that majority, which would be it now, if my math is right, would be about three people, would elect the Speaker of the House, and that Speaker is the President if the President and Vice President have been killed. That's the state of play in the United States of America today. There is no continuity plan for the third branch, the Supreme Court. Neither is there a valid and non-problematic succession line, as I just pointed out, because of this issue of who chooses the Speaker. Now, here's the possible good news. Many of the younger, newer members of Congress are realizing, thanks to COVID, that we have a problem and that we need to fix the problem. And some of the people who had resisted addressing this responsibly will soon be leaving the Congress. And I think generally people are going to realize, gosh, if COVID, which is horrible as it is, if we're not able to deal with that responsibly, what if something far worse happened? We have been, ironically, somewhat lucky in the case of September 11th because the Capitol wasn't struck by an airplane, but it could have been. As terrible as COVID is, a pandemic or a directed biochem attack could be far worse. We are not only ill-prepared for COVID, we are completely unprepared for something far worse.
And if I could just add to that, because I think that Congressman Baird's point is exactly right. So the question is, why hasn't something been done in the last 18 years, for example? And I think that this is the same reason why, despite warnings to Speaker Pelosi and Majority Leader McConnell, that they didn't take action when it was obvious what was coming. They are anxious about their own power. Anytime that you change the way the arrangements work inside the House and the Senate, that you change the rules in terms of how people vote and how people meet and how people deliberate, that the most positive interpretation is that they're institutionalists and they're very concerned about protecting the institution. The flip side is that their very power base is enmeshed in the way that the current system works, which means that any type of change makes them anxious about their ability to control what's happening. And with the proxy voting system, it moves even more power to leadership in the House than was there before, for example, which has been the history of the last 30 years of moving power away from the members and the committees to the leadership. And that, I think, and you know, maybe Congressman Baird agrees, or maybe he doesn't, or maybe doesn't simply want to go there, which is probably a wise choice on his part. But I think that a lot of the anxiety, a lot of this comes from anxiety about their ability to maintain control. And legislatures aren't always about control. They're about reasoned debate, or sometimes unreasoned debate. They're about the different interests coming together and fighting it out. It can't just be, you know, it can't just be on rails. It can't just like glide down the path. It's okay to have problems. It's okay to have disagreements. And it's okay for leadership to not always win. But I think that anxiety about control and power is a significant factor in what has stopped a lot of these reform efforts from happening. And finally, circumstances have gotten so bad that you are starting to see some movement, because reality is coming up and pushing against these sort of antiquated systems that are unable to deal with the challenges in our political space.
Okay, so very last question. The event that you all held on Thursday, is that available as a recording for our listeners to go and access?
We're hoping it will be shortly. We're just working out some of the final kinks, and we're wanting to make sure that it'll be a very usable product. We think we just have to make a couple checks with folks. But we wanted to make sure that all of our witnesses feel comfortable with us releasing it first. Margaret, there's one other thing I really want to make sure I say.
Please.
And I think it's at the core of this. The first thing you do after you're elected to Congress on the first day, the very first order of business is to take a solemn oath to support and defend the Constitution. That's the most important thing you'll do in your life, probably. And yet, by virtue of leadership not allowing the House and Senate to take action as they're constitutionally required to do, they are preventing members from upholding that sacred oath. And when we do not prepare to maintain the institutions of the Congress or the courts or the executive branch in a constitutionally valid way, we are violating our sacred oath. Right now, capable, competent, dedicated public servants, the people who were elected to serve and represent their constituents, are being prevented by leadership from fulfilling their constitutional duties. And they took an oath to uphold those constitutional duties. That has to change. This is not just about some pontificating leadership saying, oh, we're not certain about all the constitutional things. There is plenty of evidence that we can do this in a constitutionally valid way, in a way that preserves the rights of people to be representative, and we are not doing so. And it's a violation of our oath.
That seems like a good place to end. Congressman Baird, Daniel Schumann, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. The mock hearing we talked about in this episode is up on YouTube, and a link to it can be found on this episode's show page. If you haven't yet, please take a second to share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can also purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yen. As always, thanks for listening.